A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So I'm thinking about the graphene guy, your friend's friend. The one who runs his own lab and apparently also knows how to hold a normal conversation.
Daniel's prompt. Let me read what he actually wrote. He says, "We've done some recent episodes on material science, plastics, wood, metal, and it drew a connection to someone he met a couple of years ago and lost contact with. He figures we all have coarse preconceptions in our heads that probably aren't very flattering to divulge, nor very accurate. Over his life, he's known a number of people, enough to deduce a pattern from, who were both intellectually brilliant and profoundly challenged socially. He says it sounds judgmental, but he means it neutrally. When you meet people like this, it's almost a letdown. They're studying something fascinating, but they're extremely hard to just hold a normal conversation with."
Right. And then he hits the pivot.
Then he gets to the friend. This material scientist working on novel graphene applications has his own laboratory. Seemed like a sociable, agreeable guy. And the more Daniel got to know him, the more he realized the research was vastly complex, the kind of thing that made his head spin. So the question is, basically, how true is the social caricature? That the most intellectually gifted are also the most socially challenged? And is his friend an exception, or is the rule itself wrong?
So today we're going to dig into what the data actually says about this. Is there a real trade-off between IQ and social ability, or is this just a comforting story we tell ourselves?
Comforting is the word. It's comforting to think the guy who can't make eye contact at a party is paying some kind of cosmic price for his brilliance.
The mad scientist trope. It's been with us a long time. Wikipedia traces it back at least to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in 1818, the brilliant isolated researcher whose work literally creates a monster. The archetype is the genius who's so absorbed in his work that he loses touch with humanity entirely.
And it's not just Frankenstein. It's every cartoon scientist with wild hair and a lab coat who can't remember his own address. It's the absent-minded professor, the socially oblivious tech founder, the mathematician who stares at your shoes while he talks.
Think about how this plays out in popular culture right now. Every sitcom has the nerdy character who can solve quantum equations but can't ask someone on a date. Big Bang Theory built an entire 12-season run on this premise. Four brilliant physicists, varying degrees of social dysfunction, and the laugh track cues every time one of them fails to read a basic social cue.
And the show was wildly popular because people recognized the type, or thought they did. The question is whether they were recognizing a real pattern or a well-produced caricature.
That's exactly the tension Daniel's prompt sets up. He's got this real person, the graphene researcher, who doesn't fit the sitcom version at all. And then Daniel meets this graphene researcher who's normal, pleasant. Runs a lab, manages a team, presumably has to secure funding and collaborate with other labs, all of which requires social competence, and also does work so complex it made Daniel's head spin. That's the counterexample that makes the stereotype worth interrogating.
So let's start with what the psychological research actually says, because the answer might surprise you.
It surprised me. I went into this assuming there'd be at least a modest negative correlation. You know, the smarter you are, the slightly less socially adept. That's what the culture tells us. But Scientific American's coverage of the IQ personality research shows something different. The correlation between intelligence and traits like extroversion or agreeableness is weak to non-existent.
Weak to non-existent. Not small but real. Not depends how you measure it. Just not there.
Not there. And this isn't one study. It's a consistent finding across decades of psychometric research. Intelligence and sociability are largely independent dimensions. You could be brilliant and gregarious, brilliant and shy, average and socially gifted, average and awkward. The full grid exists.
Wait, I want to pause on this because I think people might not believe it. Walk me through what weak to non-existent actually means in practice.
Okay, so imagine you've got a scatterplot. IQ on the x-axis, some measure of social skill on the y-axis. If there were a strong negative correlation, which is what the stereotype predicts, you'd see a clear downward slope. High IQ, low social skill. Low IQ, high social skill. The dots would cluster along a diagonal line going down and to the right.
Right. That's what people expect.
What the data actually shows is a cloud. The dots are everywhere. There's no slope to speak of. You can pick any IQ score and find people all up and down the social skill axis. Knowing someone's IQ tells you essentially nothing about whether they're charming or awkward.
So, if I meet someone with an IQ of 140, the odds they're socially awkward are basically 50-50?
Roughly the same as the base rate in the general population. Whatever percentage of people overall struggle socially, it's about the same percentage among the highly intelligent. The traits don't predict each other.
So, why does the stereotype feel so real? Why does Daniel, and honestly, why do I feel like we've met a pattern of brilliant people who can't hold a conversation?
That's where it gets interesting. The first thing to understand is the sampling bias problem. The people we notice as brilliant but socially challenged are memorable precisely because they violate expectations in a way that sticks. You meet someone who's clearly very smart and also clearly struggling socially. That's a story. That's an anecdote you tell later.
Whereas the sociable geniuses blend in.
You meet a brilliant person who's also charming and socially fluent. You just think, what a great guy. You don't file it under exception to the mad scientist rule. You don't even notice the rule isn't operating. The counterexamples are invisible because they don't generate narrative tension.
This is like the all my exes are crazy bias. You remember the dramatic breakups. The amicable ones don't make the highlight reel of your memory.
Perfect analogy. Your brain is a storyteller, not a statistician. It retains the cases that have narrative shape, conflict, surprise, irony. The brilliant, awkward person is narratively rich. The brilliant, well-adjusted person is narratively flat. So your mental database gets stuffed with the former, and you walk around thinking you've detected a pattern.
Richard Feynman, famously gregarious, played the bongos, charmed rooms, told stories. Nobody thinks of Feynman as an exception to a rule. They just think of him as Feynman.
And Marie Curie, socially reserved, yes, but not socially disabled. She navigated the scientific establishment of her time, which wasn't exactly welcoming to women, and she did it while winning 2 Nobel Prizes. That takes a kind of social competence. The stereotype fails even on iconic geniuses if you look closely.
But Daniel's prompt isn't just about famous geniuses. He's talking about people he's actually met. Multiple people over his life who fit the pattern. That's not media representation. That's lived experience.
Right. And I don't want to dismiss that. I think there's something real going on. It's just not what it looks like. Let me introduce the threshold hypothesis. Some research suggests that beyond a certain IQ threshold, around 120 to 130, the correlation between intelligence and social competence actually flattens or reverses.
Wait, reverses? So above that threshold, smarter people might actually be more socially competent.
The data's mixed on the reversal, but the flattening is pretty clear. Beyond about 120, IQ stops predicting much about social outcomes. You've got people at 130 who are socially brilliant and people at 130 who are socially struggling. An IQ doesn't tell you which is which.
So Daniel's friend, the sociable graphene scientist, he's not an exception to a rule. He's just on one side of a distribution that has plenty of people on both sides.
And here's the thing. 120 to 130 isn't that rare. That's roughly the top 10%. Most people with PhDs are in that range. Most research scientists. So we're talking about a large population where IQ simply doesn't predict sociability.
Then why does Daniel feel like he's noticed a pattern? He said enough people to deduce one.
I think there are a few mechanisms at work. One is the savant syndrome confusion. People hear about savants, individuals with extraordinary abilities in one domain and significant deficits in others, and they implicitly model high intelligence on that template. But savant syndrome is neurologically distinct from general high intelligence. It's rare. Wikipedia's intelligence article makes this clear. Most highly intelligent people don't have social deficits. The savant isn't the prototype of the genius.
But the savant is the one who makes the news. The guy who can tell you the day of the week for any date in history but can't tie his own shoes. That's a story. The well-adjusted genius running a graphene lab isn't the story.
And the savant gets disproportionate screen time in our cultural memory. Rain Man, A Beautiful Mind. These are compelling narratives precisely because of the contrast, extraordinary ability paired with profound limitation. We're drawn to that tension. But it's a movie, not a population statistic.
So we've got this cultural diet of savant stories. We've got our own memory bias toward memorable awkward encounters, and we've got sitcoms reinforcing the trope every week. No wonder Daniel feels like he's seeing a pattern.
Another mechanism, and this one I think explains a lot of Daniel's personal experiences, is the specialized interest problem. Highly intelligent people often develop deep, narrow expertise. They know an enormous amount about a very specific thing. And that can make casual conversation genuinely difficult.
Not because they lack social skills, because the conversational frames don't match.
You meet someone at a party and you ask what they do. They say they're researching the electronic properties of twisted bilayer graphene. You say, oh, cool. And then, what? They could try to explain it, but it'd take 40 minutes and a whiteboard. They could dumb it down, but that feels condescending. They could change the subject, but now they're the one who brought up graphene and then abandoned it.
So they end up standing there awkwardly, and you walk away thinking, brilliant guy, can't hold a conversation.
When what actually happened was a frame mismatch. They don't know what you know, you don't know what they know. The conversational bridge is too long to build in casual small talk.
The curse of knowledge.
That's exactly the term. Once you know something, it's extremely hard to imagine not knowing it. There's a classic experiment where people are asked to tap out a familiar song, like Happy Birthday, with their fingers on a table and then estimate how many listeners will recognize it. The tappers predict about 50%. The actual recognition rate is about 2.5%.
Because the tapper can hear the melody in their head. They can't unhear it. The taps seem obviously musical to them.
Right, and that's what's happening in these conversations. The graphene researcher has the full symphony of their research playing in their head. They offer a few conversational taps. Twisted bilayer graphene has some fascinating electronic properties, and to them, that should be enough. The melody is so clear, but to the listener, it's just taps on a table.
So the awkwardness isn't a social deficit. It's a theory of mind failure that happens to be triggered by expertise. Put that same researcher in a conversation about, I don't know, cooking or hiking or whatever else they do, and they might be perfectly fluent.
Highly intelligent people with deep expertise suffer from this acutely. They underestimate how much others don't know. They make conversational leaps that lose people, and the result looks like social awkwardness. But it's actually a theory of mind calibration problem.
A calibration problem, not a deficit. That's a useful reframe.
Think about what happens when you put two graphene researchers in a room together. They're not awkward. They're fluent, animated, socially effortless. Because the frames match. The problem isn't that they can't do social interaction, it's that their social fluency is tuned to a very specific frequency.
And that connects to something else in Daniel's prompt. He said his friend runs his own laboratory. He's had to develop social skills, securing funding, managing a team, collaborating with other labs. None of that works if you can't communicate.
This is the environment and opportunity angle. The stereotype may be partly self-selecting. Socially challenged geniuses end up in isolated research roles where they can work alone. Sociable geniuses end up in leadership positions, running labs, building teams. We see the distribution of outcomes and mistake it for a distribution of traits.
So, there's a sorting effect. The lab head and the isolated theorist might have started with similar social aptitude, but their environments pulled them in different directions.
And then the environment reinforces itself. If you spend 10 years in a role that requires minimal social interaction, your social skills are going to atrophy, or at least not develop. If you spend 10 years running a lab, managing postdocs, schmoozing at conferences, your social skills are going to sharpen. The initial difference might have been small, but the compounded effect over a career is large.
Graphene research is a perfect case study for this. The 2010 Nobel Prize in Physics went to Andrei Geim and Konstantin Novoselov, two researchers who worked together closely. Graphene is inherently collaborative. It's material science, which means you need experimentalists and theorists, chemists and physicists, people who can fabricate and people who can characterize.
The field self selects for people who can collaborate. If you can't work with others, you're not going to thrive in graphene research. So, Daniel's friend, sociable, agreeable, running his own lab, he's not an anomaly. He's what the field produces.
Compare that to theoretical physics in the early 20th century. Paul Dirac was known for extreme social reticence. He spoke in monosyllables. His colleagues invented a unit of conversation called the Dirac, one word per hour. And he thrived. He didn't need to collaborate. He could sit in a room with a pencil and produce fundamental insights about the universe.
And Ernest Lawrence, same era, different field. Experimental physics. He was a master networker, built the Rad Lab at Berkeley, raised money, managed huge teams. Both brilliant, radically different social profiles. The field selected for different things.
So, if the data doesn't support a strong trade-off, why does this stereotype feel so real? Let's look at the mechanisms that might explain our perception.
We've touched on several. Sampling bias? The memorable cases are the ones that violate expectations. The savant confusion, we model genius on a rare neurological condition. The frame mismatch, deep expertise creates conversational friction that looks like social deficit. And the self-selection, we see the outcomes but not the sorting process.
There's another one I want to add. The general intelligence factor, G, correlates with a lot of positive life outcomes. Job performance, health, longevity, but not strongly with social competence.
Which suggests these are partially independent cognitive domains. The brain isn't a single resource pool where points spent on intelligence come out of the social budget. It's more like you've got different systems doing different things, and they develop somewhat independently.
I think the resource pool metaphor is actually worth unpacking, because I suspect that's how a lot of people implicitly think about this. Like there's a fixed budget of cognitive capacity. And if you spend it all on physics, there's nothing left for small talk.
Zero-sum model of the mind. It's intuitive, but wrong. It's like saying a professional athlete must be bad at music because they spent all their points on physical training. No, those are different systems. You can be a linebacker who also plays guitar. You can be a physicist who also reads social cues.
The clinical analogy is probably autism spectrum disorder. That's a genuine dissociation between cognitive ability and social intuition. Some people on the spectrum have very high intelligence and significant social challenges. But that's a specific neurological pattern. It's not a general feature of high intelligence.
That distinction gets collapsed in the popular imagination. People see someone who's socially awkward and intellectually brilliant and think, oh, a little bit on the spectrum or touched with genius, as if those are the same thing. They're not. Autism is a specific neurodevelopmental condition with specific diagnostic criteria. Being brilliant and being socially challenged can co-occur for entirely different reasons.
The curse of knowledge is probably the biggest one for the people Daniel's actually met. These aren't people with clinical social deficits. They're people whose conversational calibration is off, because they know too much about things most people know nothing about.
Here's a practical thing. When you meet someone brilliant who seems socially awkward, consider whether it's a genuine deficit or a conversational frame mismatch. Try adjusting your own communication style before concluding they lack social skills.
That's actionable. Ask them about their work in a way that signals you're curious, but need them to meet you where you are. I know nothing about this. Explain it to me like I'm smart but ignorant. That's a gift to someone who's used to either dumbing things down or losing people entirely.
For the brilliant person on the other side of that conversation, there's a skill to develop. The best science communicators don't dumb things down. They find the core insight that's accessible without being trivial. They build a bridge from what the listener already knows to what they need to know to appreciate the cool part.
That's hard. I don't want to pretend it's easy. Building that bridge in real time, at a party, with someone you just met, that's advanced social cognition. But it's learnable.
The second actionable insight, the mad scientist stereotype, is a cognitive shortcut that obscures the diversity of human intelligence. Actively seek out counterexamples. Daniel's friend is one, Feynman is another. They're everywhere once you start looking.
The third one, for listeners who worry about their own social skills relative to their intelligence. The research suggests these are largely independent traits you can develop separately. Don't accept the trade-off as inevitable.
That's important. I think a lot of smart young people absorb the stereotype and then live into it. Well, I'm brilliant, so of course I'm going to struggle socially. No, those are separate things. You can work on your social skills without compromising your intellectual work.
This is almost the inverse of the fixed mindset problem in education. Kids who believe intelligence is fixed stop trying when they hit a challenge. Kids who believe it's malleable push through. The same thing applies to social skills. If you believe I'm smart, therefore socially awkward is my lot in life, you won't work on it. If you believe these are independent dimensions, you might.
The friend who prompted all this, Daniel's graphene scientist, he's not an exception to a rule. He may be evidence that the rule was never real in the first place.
The rule is a story we tell ourselves. It's comforting because it explains away social discomfort. That person isn't rejecting me or failing to connect with me. They're just a genius, and geniuses are like that. It lets both parties off the hook.
It also serves a weird social function for the brilliant people themselves. If you're socially awkward and you believe the stereotype, you can reframe your awkwardness as evidence of your brilliance. I can't make small talk because my mind is occupied with higher things. That's a seductive story.
Sometimes it's true in a specific way. Your mind is occupied with higher things. But that doesn't mean it has to be. It doesn't mean the social difficulty is a necessary consequence of the intellectual depth.
All of this points to a practical conclusion, one that might change how you think about the brilliant people in your own life.
The first thing is just awareness of the sampling bias. When you meet someone brilliant and socially fluent, notice it, file it, update your mental model. Don't let the invisible counterexamples stay invisible.
The second thing is the frame mismatch in sight. If you're talking to someone brilliant and the conversation is struggling, ask yourself whether you're operating in compatible frames. They might be perfectly socially capable, just calibrated to a different audience.
If you're the brilliant person in this scenario, and a lot of our listeners probably are, recognize that the curse of knowledge is real and it's your responsibility to manage it. Not by dumbing yourself down, but by learning to read your audience and calibrate.
That's a skill like any other. It can be learned. The graphene scientist running his own lab learned it because he had to. Funding doesn't secure itself.
The third thing is the independence of these traits. Intelligence and sociability aren't in competition. You're not trading off one for the other. If you want to improve your social skills, go improve your social skills. Your IQ will be fine.
I want to go back to something Daniel said that I think is honest and uncomfortable. He said meeting these brilliant but socially challenged people is kind of a letdown. I think that's worth sitting with.
Why is it a letdown?
Because you want the whole package. You meet someone doing fascinating work, and you want them to be fascinating to talk to. You want the conversation to match the resume. And when it doesn't, when the person who can explain the electronic structure of graphene can't manage 5 minutes of small talk, there's a disappointment. It feels like a missed opportunity.
I think that disappointment is actually evidence that the stereotype is wrong. If we really believed brilliance and social difficulty went together, we wouldn't be disappointed. We'd expect it. The letdown is your brain registering a violated expectation.
The expectation that interesting people should be interesting to talk to, which is reasonable and often true.
Often true. Daniel's friend is proof of that. The guy runs a graphene lab, and he's sociable and agreeable. The whole package exists.
But this also raises a bigger question. One we'll leave you with.
If intelligence and sociability are independent, what other stereotypes about cognitive traits might we be getting wrong? The absent-minded professor, the tortured artist, the dumb jock. How many of these are real correlations, and how many are just memorable stories we've mistaken for patterns?
The dumb jock one is interesting. There's actually decent evidence that physical activity improves cognitive function, so the stereotype might be exactly backwards.
The tortured artist, the idea that creativity requires suffering, there's a whole episode in that. How much of that's a real link between mood disorders and certain kinds of creativity? And how much is us romanticizing the Van Gogh story because it's more compelling than the story of the well-adjusted artist who paints during business hours and has a healthy family life?
We're pattern-seeking animals who love a good story. The problem is that good stories and accurate models of reality don't always overlap.
As AI and collaboration tools reshape how we work, the social demands on brilliant people are probably going to increase, not decrease. The era of the lone genius in a room with a pencil, that's already mostly over. Science is team science now. The graphene model, not the Dirac model.
Which means the stereotype will erode further. The selection pressure is towards sociability. The people doing the most interesting work will increasingly be people who can also communicate, collaborate, and lead.
Daniel's friend isn't an exception. He's the future.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show happen.
This has been my weird prompts. If you have a weird prompt that challenges your own assumptions, the way Daniel's did, send it to us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We might just build an episode around it.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.